This episode of Very Vedic is brought to you by Learn to Let Go, a unique and powerful audio course from Matt and Anna that will help you let go of whatever's holding you back. For details, go to bondimeditation.com.au/learn-to-let-go. Hello, Anna.
Hello, Matt.
Welcome back to Bondi.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Anna's here visiting Bondi, so we thought we'd sneak in a quick podcast episode. Mm-hmm. Got a slightly different idea for this one, which I did mention to you, Anna, so you do know, but you don't know how it's going to unfold.
No.
But basically, I thought we'd turn the tables on this one, and I'd ask the questions.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of people listening will be interested in your journey.
I think maybe one or two.
Well, I'm interested. And I'd like to, you know, get a bit of an insight into your journey and just how Vedic meditation and Vedic knowledge has changed things for you, you know, in a real way in your actual life.
Yes.
So we met, it would have been about 2.5, 3 years ago. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, something like that.
And we were doing I was doing a group meditation and you were there. Mm. And then you came up at the end. Do you remember what you said to me?
Hi. I don't think it was anything too exciting.
Well, you were interested in the knowledge though.
Yes.
And you kind of said, how can I find out more about this?
Yeah.
And he ended up working for us. Yeah. And then we started doing the podcast because I realized you couldn't stop asking questions.
Yeah.
And that was perfect. Yeah, so obviously since then, we've spent 2.5 seasons of this podcast talking and thinking about this Vedic knowledge. Mm. And yeah, I'd like to hear how it's been influencing you, kind of what's worked, what hasn't worked. So I just want to start by asking you, if you can, to cast your mind back to how it felt to be Anna before you started doing regular twice daily Vedic meditation. Let's go right back to then. So when you met me, were you meditating regularly twice a day?
So when I'd met you, I'd learned meditation, and it was probably a couple of years before I met you, and I was living in Perth. I learned it here in Sydney, and then I moved to Perth, and I didn't keep it up at all. I think I meditated once every kind of week or something. I didn't have a community there, and I think that was a huge part of kind of not seeing it as something that was significant or profound. I remember when I came to Bondi Meditation and there was a whole community of people doing it going, oh my goodness, this is amazing. It kind of had felt like a very solo journey beforehand, and I think I probably connected meditating with pain at that point. Yeah, I recall, and I think that this was probably where I was at in my life when I learned it. It was kind of a very lonely period of my life. I don't think I was in a very good place. And so I associated meditation and being with my own mind for 2 times 20 minutes a day as a very lonely experience. Mm. And I actually think I remember asking that very early on, how do I not feel lonely when I meditate?
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah. And you said something like, it will become an experience where you feel basically exactly the opposite, that you'll be very connected to everything. And that is what my meditation has become. But I was just kind of terrified of sitting there and being with my thoughts for 40 minutes a day.
Okay, so what changed? You say that you entered BMC and saw the community. I suppose, you know, two parts to the question. What was it about having a community that made meditation feel different to you? And just generally, what changed to take you from the loneliness to the connection? What happened that was different?
I think the community was a helpful way of me maybe being able to gently enter into that experience, which did feel lonely at that time, with a group of other people. Yeah. So I knew, actually, I'm not alone. I'm with a whole group of people. And there was just something very profound about all of these people being on the same wavelength and kind of elevating their consciousness together. It was like, oh, my people, you know, when you kind of find a tribe. Mm-hmm. And then what was your second question? How did I move from the loneliness?
Yeah. So how I'm interested in how the practice changed from something that you associated with pain and specifically loneliness to something where you felt connection. That sounds like a very a complete 180. How did that happen? And did it take a while?
That took a long time for me. That took a really long time. And it definitely wasn't something that happened overnight. I think that I just became more accepting with feeling, with the experience of meditation. I think it was just actually being okay with sitting in loneliness for 40 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. And probably having some, every now and then, these amazing connected experiences in meditation. And I'm talking about maybe once every few months going, oh, maybe I just transcended, you know. Mm. Oh, I feel connected to something bigger than myself. Mm. It was these little things along the way, these little things of like these treasure things that I was like, oh, there's something in this that just kept me going. And actually it was the community that allowed me to kind of stay in the game and explore further and to find more of those moments.
All right. So this is interesting. So the meditation wasn't gratifying for you. It doesn't sound like it's particularly gratifying or enjoyable in itself.
Not at all. I remember just thinking, why am I sitting here thinking with my eyes closed for 40 minutes a day?
Yeah.
Why am I why would I do this to myself? This is hellish. I don't want to. I can think with my eyes open. Why would I think with my eyes closed and feel bad?
Okay, so when I hear this as a teacher, immediately I'm starting to sense maybe a slight technique issue. Did you at any point refresh? I can't remember. Did you do a refresher session with us or revisit the technique, and did that make any difference? Don't feel like you have to say yes.
Yes, I did a refresher session with you when we started working together. And it was in the refresher session that I just heard you say, what you're experiencing in the meditation, it was something like this, isn't necessarily an indicator of how effective the meditation is. And actually, sometimes the best meditations you can have is sometimes you might be in pain the whole time, or, you know, they might feel kind of horrible to be in. And it was that refresher. I don't know. I think I'd heard it a couple of times before, but it was that just hearing it in a different way, or the time that I heard it at where it just kind of sunk in. And I was like, you know what? I'm in this for the long game. If I have to have, it was a level of deep acceptance that it did actually come through a refresher session where I just went, I'm just going to do this thing, and if it takes 3 years of being in this painful meditation thinking, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, so it sounds like there was a lot of stress being released and some discomfort. But when you realized, like anything, when you recontextualized that as being okay, you stopped resisting it. And when we stop resisting it and trying to control it, Vedic meditation gets easier.
Yeah.
And more enjoyable.
Absolutely. And you know what else is good about the community is that I heard all of these other people with the same having the same things. Heard people going, Matt, I'm closing my eyes for 20 minutes and I'm thinking, why am I doing this? And I was like, oh, great. Me too. And what I will say is that I was reflecting the other day, and I don't want this to be like people to kind of listen and go judge where you're at, because what I have learned is that anywhere you're at on the meditation journey truly is perfect. But my experience of meditation is completely different now, and how quickly I drop in now, and I don't find myself thinking for most of the time these days during meditation.
Yeah. And what do you put that down to? Do you put that down to like the fact that you've released a lot of stress in the earlier meditations and now there's less stress release going on? Or do you put it down to the fact that you're now totally surrendered to whatever happens in the practice? What does it feel like?
I think it's a combo of those things, but it's also something to do with, I think I've just trained my mind to really quickly enter into that state. it's like I close my eyes and I sit down in a certain way, and I'm giving my body my mind, psyche, whatever, the indicator that this is happening now, and we're going in. And it just, like, say it's an elevator that used to take a certain amount of time to get to a certain point. It's just like the elevator goes boom, and I'm in.
Yeah. So what happens, the more we meditate and visit those more subtle states of consciousness, the more we like drill a channel down into there, and we find ourselves being able to move much more easily into a deeper state. Mm-hmm. And this can be obvious when, for example, say after a yoga class, you're laying down in Shavasana, and you might have used to lay in Shavasana and feel restless, or the time might have dragged, but now, vroom, you transcend in it. You go and have a massage, vroom, you transcend.
Yes.
So once you've created this channel, it becomes much easier and quicker to transcend.
Mm-hmm. And I think my mind just really likes going there now. There's such an association of going to it now with pleasure.
Yeah, your mind always liked to go there because it's greater fulfillment, and that's all the mind is ever looking to do. The difference is now, the two things that we said, there's less stress bringing you back up and inhibiting your experience of that deeper, more fulfilled state, and there's less resistance from you when there is stress.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of those two things allow your mind to go where it naturally wants to go,
yeah,
which is that state of de-excitation, that state of fulfillment. Mm.
That's it. And when you're saying, yeah, you said there's less resistance when there is stress, I totally believe that, because now, like, if there's stress coming up, or if I'm having a really thinky meditation, which isn't that often with the thoughts, I'm just kind of like, there's no resistance. I'm curious and I'm a bit excited. I'm like, yes, my body's found something. There's something else that's been found that needs to be released here.
That's a real knack and a real kind of penny drop moment when that happens in a meditation. It's like you start to become this strangely, slightly, subtly masochistic.
Yes.
It's like there is stress, there is a bit of discomfort, but you enjoy the process of settling into that and allowing it rather than resisting it. And as you do this, you find that you can kind of transcend off the discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
That's it.
Okay, so you were feeling a bit lonely at this point and before you started meditating. What else was going on in your life at that time? How were you feeling in general?
You know, I remember feeling somewhat disconnected from something larger than myself. Mm. And I remember always having this thought, like around when I met you, of, oh my God, I'm spinning plates. I've just got so many things spinning. And I was in, you know, we talk about creation, maintenance, destruction. I was in a very maintenance mode. And I could feel destruction around the corner, though I didn't know that at the time.
Like the plates were going to wobble and fall off.
Yes, but I kind of wanted them to. I was like, I'm so over maintaining these things in my life. There were things in my life that I felt like were expired. A lot of my life, the work that I was doing, certain relationships that I was having, the place that I was living in, and I remember thinking, I need to let some plates fall, because I'm spending so much energy holding up these things. And actually, one of the plates was this kind of this spiritual school, I'll say, that I was in. And I was kind of there because some of my friends were there and my ex-partner was there, and it was something that I think I thought that I had to keep continuing. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to take 2 weeks off. I'm going to take 2 weeks off because it doesn't feel right for me. And it felt like a really big thing taking that time off. And the day I took the first day off, I came to Bonnet Meditation and I met you.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, this is huge. I know that this is a huge thing. I know this is, it felt really right being there. And the next day you called me and said, do you want to work for me? And
oh,
so
it,
the
oh, wow.
next day, and so yeah. I was like, wow, I need to be here.
So not to be competitive, but for the interest of comparison, you came from one kind of spiritual school or spiritual philosophy, mm-hmm. And then you came to a discussion about Vedic knowledge, basically, the Greek meditation. So can you remember anything that appealed to you about the Vedic
100%, I can remember it very, very well. In the spiritual school that I was in, I always felt like it was like I felt like I was contorting myself, that I was like, what do they say is some shape trying to be another shape.
Oh, you mean like trying to put a square peg in a round hole?
Yes, that was me. Okay. And I kind of felt like I had to become somebody else, or I had to play by these very strict rules. There was a lot of shoulds around the way that I felt I had to be within that spiritual school to be able to, to be accepted in it or something like that. And I remember coming to the meditation center and going and hearing some of the Vedic knowledge, and for me it just felt so loving and so accepting, and I had this initial thing of like relief. I don't have to contort myself, or like I don't have to try and be anything other than what I am. It just felt more natural for me, a lot of the philosophies.
Yeah, obviously I know exactly what you mean about that, because there feels like there's less human interpretation put on top of Vedic knowledge. It is simply an observation of the laws of nature, and it's only useful if you can observe those laws of nature acting in the same way yourself.
Yeah.
So there's no judgment or scorebook. Everyone's experience is respected because everyone's experience and interpretation of life is true to them in their state of consciousness. So nothing's prohibited, and it's not didactic.
That's it. And I think at that time, what was in the other school was there was a lot being prohibited, and a lot that I had to do to kind of like be validated in that world or something like that. I'm getting so high.
Okay, so we just took a little break there because Anna got a bit overwhelmed actually talking about the past, and just ran up and down the stairs, I believe, Anna, is that what we just did?
I felt my fight flat kicking in. I was like, I got to move.
Okay, so on the third floor here, and Anna just ran up and down the stairs.
You could hear my breath.
Okay, so what happened for you there, Anna?
I think going back to that time in my life, I haven't revisited in a while, and I'm throwing my mind back there. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a very strange time in my life. Mm-hmm. And something about going back there right now just feels, it's bringing up some anxiety, I think. Okay. Something. Yeah.
So is the anxiety around how you felt at the time, or how it might have felt to have persisted in that life?
Oh, both. Mm. Probably both. It was definitely a sliding doors moment, or a fork in the road, where I feel like I could have gone one of two ways.
And what do you think would have happened if you had carried on in that way?
Do you know what? I actually don't think it could have gone on for that much longer, because I think that the universe would have kicked me right out of there.
Yeah, so it did gently, and you you went with charm.
Yes.
The charm to come to Bondi meditation.
Yes.
And then that opened up new unknown avenues to explore.
Yes.
Rather than waiting for the aversion, which would have been the alternative, just to keep doing the same thing until it became unbearable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a bit of that. I think I was doing a bit of the same thing and it did become unbearable. Hence, that's probably how I got to the meditation center.
There are degrees, of course.
Yeah.
We usually do perpetuate something to some extent, but then there's the extent to which real disaster strikes.
Sure. Yeah. And it was no real disaster, just an internal sense of doom.
Okay, so what happened to the plates? That's what I'm thinking. The spinning plates, what happened to those?
The plates stopped spinning.
And did they fall off, or did you just take them off and put them in a neat pile?
Look, a bit of both. I would love to have said the latter, that I just neatly took them all off and put them in a pile. But no, there was a lot of them fell as well. And what I will say is having a meditation practice throughout that time when a lot of things were coming to an end and the plates were stopping spinning, and having the knowledge and the community was so important, and maybe what gave me the courage to enter into the destruction, I suppose, or the death of that time.
Yeah, so I feel like the spinning plates analogy was spinning things which have become irrelevant for your evolution. They're things which need to be artificially maintained by you.
That's it. And it takes so much energy.
To keep them going.
To keep them going.
Mm.
Yep. Because it's like it's you, little you, against huge nature. And what I will say now is I'm so much more aware of if I am spinning a plate or plates, I don't think I really do that often ever anymore. Mm-hmm. The key philosophy for me that I've learnt and really practiced and I do feel like mostly for the most part I'm embodying now is charm. Charm has revolutionized my life. I think it was charm that really moved me into a different period of my life at that point. I remember we talked about it in a podcast pretty early on and it kind of blew my mind.
Okay, so why don't you give me your definition of charm? Forget all the terms you may have heard me use. Describe your experience and definition of charm. How does it work for you?
For me, charm is when I feel a pull and it feels like it's something larger than myself. And I just have to say yes. That's it. And a beauty that I found in charm and, you know, something I'm still practicing daily is like I don't have to make all these decisions that I thought I needed to make. And in a way I can take myself a little bit out of the equation sometimes and just go, all right, universe, what do you want? What are you trying to tell me? Where do you want me to go? I'll do that. Just give me a clear sign.
Yeah, because having loads of choices is actually really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And just having one is blessed relief, really.
Yeah, that's it. And it kind of takes away some of the, oh, am I making the right decision? Am I making the right choice? Like, which one's better? And it's just like, no, there's a choice that the universe has already made for you and you just need to, like, get in that slipstream of that choice. Now, I don't want to say that I do it every single time because even at the moment I'm in a place where I'm like, wait, I can't really hear what the charm message is right now. But that's something I try to do all the time.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. Like just the very act of thinking about decisions all the time takes you out of the process of enjoying it.
That's it. Yeah. If I could have learned, if I could take one takeaway from everything I've learned from you, Matt, from Tom Knowles, from different podcasts, from Monday Night Group Meditations, from our Letting Go course, everything, it would probably be just follow charm and let go of that which is not charming.
Okay, yeah, so I'm sure you're not alone in charm being a kind of revolutionary technique. Are there any other specific Vedic teachings or learnings that have been really practical and helpful for you in your life?
Sure. I'm not trying to advertise our new course, but letting go is like everything as well. I'm pretty sensitive to when I am holding on to something and when I need to let go of something. And even if in that moment I'm choosing not to let go, like I'm like, this is too hard. I just want to hold in this moment. I don't want to let go of this attachment or it feels too hard right now. I'm generally like, I know that that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you said before, if you could just like let go and accept everything, you would become enlightened right now. I think it's every charm and letting go are the two biggest things, I would say.
Okay. Can you give me a specific example in your life? Tell us a story of where letting go has made the difference.
Okay. Wow. There's been a lot over the past couple of years. I would say, look, I moved to Byron like 9 months ago and it kind of didn't make total sense, much sense on paper because I was in a relationship and my sisters were both about to give birth or in the coming months and, you know, life here was, I would say, in inverted commas, pretty sweet and good.
In Bondi or in Sydney?
In Bondi, yeah. In Sydney. And but yet there was a pull. And I heard the charm signal pretty strongly and the turnaround was very quick. Heard the charm signal was there in 2 weeks. But it didn't come without letting go. There was a lot of letting go. There was a lot of letting go of comfort, of like, you know, and ideas of what I thought my life should look like or what felt really comfortable for me because I didn't know anybody there. And, you know, it's pretty comforting. It's Byron Bay. It's not the sticks, but it was still like just a huge jump in a deep end. I didn't really have a job that I was heading to or anything. So,
And did it make sense straight away when you got there? Was it obvious why charm had led you there? Is it obvious yet why charm led you there?
it didn't make sense. No, I don't think it did make any sense. I didn't know anybody. and I wanted a lot of community at that time, yet I was going to a place I didn't know anybody. And I didn't really have work lined up. So no, it didn't make sense for a while.
But does it make sense now?
Yeah.
And what sense does it make?
You know what? It makes sense because I don't think I've been this happy in a really long time. I feel expanded, feel happy, have a community now, have been living in nature. I think that was a huge part of it. I didn't realize how much I desired to live in nature. That's been pretty revolutionary as well. I mean, I could give so many reasons why it makes sense, but just I feel really good most of the time.
Yeah, and that's where charms are ultimately leading us. There'll be plenty of twists and turns along the charm route, but don't worry, the more we follow charm, the more we'll start to consistently feel that sense of happiness and alignment that we're in the right place, doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that when you follow charm, sometimes a lot of the time you don't know why you're doing something. And then it's such a good question, does it make sense now? Because in retrospect, you can look back and go, yeah, I get it. I get it now.
Yeah, so that's a really good example of following charm and letting go, all bundled up into one.
Yeah.
Your two favourite pieces of Vedic knowledge that you really embody.
Mm.
And of course, those two things are often intertwined. And specifically letting go, you know, where would you say and how has letting go helped you? So not just what you let go of, but how you did it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I was in a really long-term relationship. Mm-hmm. Really, like, kind of one of those ones that you're like, this equals marriage and children and lifetime, you know. And that was a huge letting go. It's funny because when I look back on that period of my life, and I think I'll always have this now, this memory, it was so, so sad and it was so beautiful.
The letting go part.
It was so beautiful. I remember soon after we broke up, my partner and I, it was so, like, it's devastating. You have to move out of a home together and get rid of all the furniture and all that. And it's just like so yucky. But I remember also that period of time being so beautiful, and I think that was a level of acceptance that I was having around it.
Yeah, I know what you mean about that feeling. I think it's a really clear experience of truth and the relief that comes with that, how freeing it feels. Because the end of a relationship is the truth coming to the surface, and that truth has usually been pushed down for quite a while. So yeah, it can feel beautiful to come back into the truth, basically. And can you remember, this might be tricky, but can you remember any particular aspects of the knowledge or techniques which helped you through that process?
I actually recall you, Matt, saying like something about relationships coming to an end, that in the kind of Vedic worldview, you can almost celebrate it. Because what it actually is two people following their evolution and sometimes holding on to things, even though it feels safer and it can feel more comforting and, say, better, inverted commas, you're actually holding each other back. And maybe there was a kind of reframing of that time from something that, you know, like, oh, we've failed. This has been a failed relationship because we didn't get married and all this kind of stuff, and reframing that and going, no, we're both actually really going to be fine and okay and better than okay, because something has come to an end here, or something has served its evolutionary purpose, and now we're going to go into like greater depths of evolution. So maybe flipping it on its head from something that was potentially like a failed thing to actually this was perfect as it was. It was beautiful, and now there's more adventure to be had outside of each other.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let's talk about how this knowledge has affected your relationships in general, kind of the meditation, but the knowledge also, how it's affected your relationships, different types of relationships, so family, romantic. Can you talk about that? Let me maybe start with family. How has this knowledge affected your family relationships?
Yeah, I think that I'm probably, I mean, I'm home now visiting and I haven't been home in a long time. And I can, there's that saying, like, if you think that you're enlightened, go and hang out with your family. And I can really testify to this, like, experiment, because not that I think I'm enlightened by any stretch, but man, families are triggering as much as I love them. It's just triggering. But what I will say is that I do feel so, I actually just feel a lot more accepting of who my family are and not trying to change them. Right. So there's this Vedic kind of saying, I guess, don't bewilder the ignorant, which is like, the way I understand it is, don't talk to people on a level of consciousness that they wouldn't understand. And with family and friends, just not trying to like push my belief system or understanding on them. And I think that I used to try to, you know, more when I was younger, and try and get people to understand where I was at, and getting upset when they didn't understand something that I thought was the way, you know, the conscious way or something, which is actually quite an unconscious thing to do.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I'm sure it's not exclusive to Vedic knowledge, but when we learn this, automatically we want to teach it, and we want to teach it to everyone, but over time we realize that what we need to do is embody it and uplift through our example, and that's the effective way. The other way is just annoying.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, so I think that all in all, I do feel more acceptance, just like for where my who my family are, who all the members in my family are, and what they believe in and what they value, and yeah, so I would say that the relationships have become easier.
And what about romantic? So you've already talked about the end of a significant relationship, but do you find your perception of, understanding of, or approach to romantic relationships is different now in any way?
I think if I was to summarize my experiences of romantic relationships as of recently, I would say that there's been more acceptance of the other being who they are, and not trying to make them meet a significant need within me. And maybe that's because I'm experiencing more of a level of fulfillment in myself than I have in a long time. So I don't feel like I necessarily need the other to meet those needs for me.
Yeah, I understand what you mean.
Yeah, and so there's actually been a kind of beauty in inverted commas being on my own during this period of time, because I actually really like my own company. And not that I'm closed off to another, but maybe there's less neediness for another in a romantic sense.
Yeah, I've heard I think it was Tom talked recently about how being single is underrated, because you get to do whatever you want, whenever you want. You make all your own choices. You don't have to surrender loads of preferences. And when we're in a relationship, we surrender loads of preferences and quite often do things we don't really want to do, all for about 14 minutes of unity a day.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a good celebration of singledom.
Yeah.
Or singlehood, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. How has this knowledge interacted with your sense of purpose? Has it affected what you feel your purpose to be?
The first thing that just came up for me is like, I don't know if I'm at a place yet where I'm like, I know exactly what my dharma is in this lifetime. I know exactly what my purpose is, what I'm meant to be doing. But actually, that's kind of become less relevant to me, because I feel like it's more about how I am in the world than what I'm doing, if that makes sense. I know that if I just keep following charm, my really, like, my dharma is bound to at some point become super obvious to me, but I'm really enjoying the process. And I think in many ways I am living in my dharma, but you know what used to really get me down is I'd go, what am I doing in my life? What am I supposed to be doing? Oh no, like, I don't know. And now I'm like, actually, how am I moving through the day? How am I speaking with people? Am I being nice?
And if I may say, this is your dharma. So your dharma is literally having contact with creative intelligence and doing what it wants you to do. But if you're following charm, you're following your dharma. You're in your dharma, regardless of what job you're doing. I'm glad you said that, because this is often a misunderstanding that people have between, you know, a funding mechanism, let's say, or a job, and our dharma. And our dharma can be absolutely anything, and essentially it comes down to the way we're living our life.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, and if you're following charm, then you'll be doing the right job for you.
Yes, I love that. And I think, yeah, I used to think that I had to do this, have this big life and have this big important job. And I actually think that maybe part of my charm is like that there is something, there is going to be some important job. And I actually, the job I'm doing right now does feel important. But yeah, it, that there's less pressure around that. There's less pressure around having this thing to, that will externally validate me in the world, maybe to other people.
I love the Maharishi story where he talked about, you know, how wide you have to go. How wide does your appeal need to be? You know, to be significant, do you need to have a global reach and talk to millions of people, have millions of people following you? And his answer to that was, he said, have you ever been to a beach? Yeah. And have you been down by the shore where the water meets the sand? Yeah. Where the sand is wet. And if you dig down there, you dig down, keep digging down, what do you find starts appearing?
Water.
That's right. And if you keep digging, but you may have done this as a child, but you're trying to keep digging it just really deep and really narrow, you can't. It always widens out. So the depth of the teaching will bring the breadth of influence. So let me explain what I think, how I interpret.
I've just scrunched my eyebrows at Matt. I don't understand.
Let me explain what I interpret from that. Bigger doesn't always mean better. I feel like the deep, most authentic communication of your dharma, and the more authentically you express that dharma, the broader the influence in any way, which is really important.
I get it.
So if you can teach a smaller number of people, for example, very deeply, that will naturally have an exponential effect. Rather than, for example, going out and trying to teach tens of thousands of people a technique which might change their life 1%, what Maharishi is advocating is teaching 10 people how to utterly transform their lives. And they will then transform the lives of those around them, and so on. So I think this comes back to this idea of dharma and not needing to worry about necessarily the scale of what we do, but the quality of what we do and the intimacy with our own dharma.
Yes. Yeah, huge. That really resonates with
me. It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's beautiful, yeah.
Okay, so another question for you. Since you know, been meditating twice a day, learning all this Vedic knowledge, have you found that that's affected your lifestyle choices in any way?
Are you talking about like drinking alcohol and stuff like that? I think I know you.
Yes, maybe among other things.
Yeah. I would say, I want to be able to say like, oh, I eat really well all the time and I exercise well all the time and I don't drink ever. That's just not true. This stuff comes and goes in waves. I go through periods where I feel like being there's charm to be very clean, and I'll pull back from drinking any alcohol and, you know, maybe going out and doing, inverted commas, naughty, cheeky things. And then there are times where I just go for it. I just find myself on a dance floor, couple of wines in, going for it. Well, what I will say is that I'm more sensitive. Like, for example, to alcohol, I'm more sensitive. I feel generally affected by it the next day. So I can't have as much. And I'm a cheap date because it doesn't take me much to feel anything. I have to look at a glass of wine and I'm like, I think I'm tipsy. But I think that, look, I don't know if I'm making this up to make myself feel better, but I'll just talk about alcohol at this stage. It's actually been pretty relevant for me to dip into that and to dip into a little bit of party, I think, unless it's an attachment. But I, I think my life was quite structured before, and I, you know, was in relationship and a great job, and then like coming into like independent living, like single life and stuff like that, it actually has just felt quite relevant for me to go and get a few wines on the town every now and then. Am I lying to myself?
I don't think you are, no. So there's not like a list of do's and don'ts, actually, in the way that some people and some spiritual organisations prescribe. The Vedic view is that nothing's prohibited, and you'll have a desire to do things, you'll feel charm to do things which remain relevant, and that will be differing degrees. So for me, I think most people know, who know me know that I learned to meditate, the desire for alcohol totally went. And that was because it was totally irrelevant to my evolution. I'd done plenty of research in that area, and I was going to be a meditation teacher, so it totally went. But for most other people, that doesn't happen. They may find that they moderate, or they feel the inclination to moderate their consumption, or they may find that they want to drink more, which sounds a bit like what you're saying, just slightly, within reason. Not to a damaging extent, but to an extent which is relevant for their dharma. And your dharma includes dancing and enjoying yourself at the moment with a couple of wines. And that's beautiful. Yeah. And that's you.
Yeah. I want to talk about this more, because, you know, we were talking about before, I was kind of in that spiritual, that school, and I felt like I had to kind of be someone who I wasn't sometimes. And there was rules, like, you know, it very strict, no drinking. They couldn't monitor what you were doing, but the kind of what they would say is like, basically you shouldn't drink and you shouldn't take drugs. And there's the kind of list of shoulds and shouldn'ts, and something in me, I go, I want to do that thing more because I'm not allowed to. And so that's been a really beautiful thing, like learning about the Vedic worldview and kind of there being none of this, oh, you're not allowed to do this or you're not allowed to do that. There's such a freedom in that, and the the exploration, the kind of experimentation guided by the self is really important.
There's really just one rule. And it's actually not even a rule unless you're the kind of person who is receptive to the rule. And that is, don't cause suffering to yourself or to others. And karma is set up to help us learn that that's not a good thing, bit by bit.
Mm. Yeah, that's such a loving approach. Yeah, someone said something to me recently, actually. They said, no, it was a meditation teacher, Vedic meditation. And they said, no, go do whatever you want. Just keep the light switched on. And I really loved that. I loved that. I was like, great, I have freedom to do whatever I want, but keep the light on. And when my light's on, I know if I want to do that or not. And if I want to do it, it's usually not something that's going to hurt me or somebody else. So that's probably where I'm at right now in terms of like the lifestyle choices, maybe some of the other ones that I would say are maybe less clean or pure or whatever. It's like, I guess what I try and keep my lights on. I wouldn't get myself, I don't think, into a place now where I would be blind drunk, because I need a little bit of light on to go, am I really liking this? Am I enjoying this? If so, great. If not, maybe don't do that thing. On the theme of talking about like light, the light being switched on, I think something huge that I would love to say around what I've learned and developed throughout this whole journey is a witness. The witness is huge. So that maybe that's another term for, you know, interchangeable with a light being switched on.
Yeah, so this is what Krishna refers to in the Bhagavad Gita as being established in being. Mm-hmm. The witness is that state of awareness that we have when we're established more in being than we are in the mind and body. So we have that broader background awareness, which acts as the wise overseer of the mind and body's lower impulses. It witnesses and guides the response to any situation. And that establishment in being moves by increment. So before we start to meditate, let's say we're totally established and identified with the mind and the body.
Yes.
And you start to meditate, do your two a day, and then you start to feel, you come out, you're like, you might be quite established in being maybe, I don't know, 20% for 5 minutes. And as time goes on, you establish in a higher percentage for a longer period of time until eventually in full enlightenment, you're 100% established in being all of the time.
Mm.
So you will always act from the most loving and wise place rather than what your body tells you to just because it feels like it, regardless of how it will mess things up.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I found like it's not that like I think I still experience lower levels of consciousness frequently. Like I'm not definitely not near enlightened. I experience body sensations like before that like old stuff comes up and stresses and I go into confusion and sometimes I think I make mistakes and like there's all that going on. But there's this funny, like I'm kind of just always aware of it. Mm. You know, there's like this and it's like I'm doing these things, but at the same time, I'm aware of my patterns and I'm aware that I'm deep in confusion and I'm aware that this is going on. And it adds a different kind of quality.
I would say, Anna, that you're more enlightened than you realize.
Great.
Yeah, so experiencing uncomfortable body sensations and making impure lifestyle choices are not evidence of a lack of enlightenment. The enlightenment's in the awareness. And awareness is consciousness. And as we know, consciousness has within its nature playfulness. And that playfulness can lead us to do things which don't look to be, strictly speaking, by the book evolutionary, but through their playfulness actually provide evolution in themselves.
Go on. Can you give an example of that?
Yeah, an example of that might be that you want to go out and dance and have a couple of glasses of wine. When you could be staying in, studying Vedic texts, meditating for longer, listening to Samaved, having an Ayurvedic meal and purifying the physiology.
Yes.
Because actually, in your particular story, because we've got to remember what Dharma wants to achieve. Dharma wants to achieve the upliftment for yourself and the greatest evolution for the others that you come into contact with. And your particular skills may be best suited on that particular evening to meeting people and uplifting them on a dance floor with a couple of wines under your belt.
Yeah.
So that would be an example.
Yeah. I actually met a female meditation teacher and she said, yeah, you wouldn't believe how many students I meet at pubs. She's like, it's totally relevant for me to have a wine every now and then. That's where I meet heaps of people.
Yeah, there you go. Case in point. Could you describe your consistent experience of life today, like everyday life? How do you feel?
This is a really good question. Because I would say that ultimately there are no bad days anymore, really. Even if I'm having there's some shitty stuff coming up or shitty, you know, patterns or, you know, the experiences that are, I don't know, seem less than lovely. There's something that I feel in myself that I'm like, I'm always okay. Mm. Everything's kind of always okay, no matter what's going on.
Yeah, because your life's becoming less field dependent. You're less dependent on external circumstances for your fulfillment and to have a good day. People say to me, how was your day? And I say, yeah, it's good. And they say, what do you do? I go, if I really think about it, oh yeah, I got a parking ticket, paid that, drove Jack to boxing, took an extra half an hour because of the traffic, and went to the podiatrist for my plantar fasciitis.
Yeah. Oh, I have that too. Fun.
Do you?
Oh,
yeah. Right, yeah. I'll give you his number. Once you connect to that inner field of fulfillment, and it's really by Vedic meditation, it's the only way I know how to do that, then there's a kind of liveliness, a playfulness in all things. And there's definitely a kind of a satisfaction that comes from creatively meeting challenges. And as trite as it sounds, fulfillment does start to be derived from all aspects of life, good, bad, and ugly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, yeah, often now when a challenge comes up, I'm like, ooh, this is like, there's a bit of intrigue. It's probably, there's a curiosity. I'm like, ooh, there's something here and there's something here that needs to be learnt. How interesting.
Yeah, the world is constantly bringing us inquiry. And it's inquiry that activates our wisdom. And it feels good to experience and act on our wisdom.
Yeah.
So the need of the time, any kind of challenges that come up, are a form of inquiry from the universe to us saying, are you creative enough to provide the solution to this?
Oh, I like that. I really like that. I actually like want to talk about this a little bit more because you asked, like what my consistent experience of life is. And I do think it's important to say that when I reflect upon what my life was like, I think that I was quite an emotional, inconsistent person. Like I did experience a lot of like turbulence and emotions in a day. You know, it wasn't very healthy or sustainable. And I just remember, it was kind of like, a lot of things could shake me and rock me. And I feel these days a little bit more like a tree, a little bit like my branches can shake, but there's something really, really solid and connected to something.
So you're not saying you don't experience emotions now?
That's not at all what I'm saying. There's definitely emotions. But there's something that the way that I've like written it down in my journal is like, there's, I always know on some level I'm okay, no matter what. There's something fine here.
If I may be so bold, that's because you're identifying more with the part of you which absolutely is always fine.
That's it.
Yeah, it's the pure consciousness, which you know is your deepest essence on some level, and which is untouchable, unblemished by any experience and always will be. So the more you identify with that, clearly the stronger and more fearless you'll feel.
Yep, that's definitely, can testify from my experience.
Great. Okay, let's change tack a little bit. Is there any aspect of the knowledge that you've experienced and discovered, the Vedic knowledge, which you felt resistance towards? And has that resistance changed? Has your relationship with that aspect of knowledge changed over time?
Yeah, I feel resistance. I have felt a lot of, and still feel sometimes a lot in brackets, resistance towards death, the force of death. Like,
do you mean dissolution, as in the death of anything, or particularly physical death of
people? But also things coming to an end that once were good. Really has rattled me, and is something that I think the force that I feel most like gravity around when I think about it.
So is this because you feel an attachment to the things you love?
Yes.
Yes.
That's it. Yeah, and there's a part of me, I don't know if it's like my inner little child or something, that just wants to hold and grasp when something's going good, or a beautiful relationship in my life, whether that's a partner or a family member or an experience even. Looking at a beautiful sunset, I can have a thing of, oh my God, I don't want this to end. And intellectually, I understand, I have understood for a long time that there's a profoundness in it coming to an end and being able to let that go and make way for the new thing. I guess on a bodily sensation level, it's the thing that I still experience the most kind of grief and pain around, I would say.
I think this is one of the things that's beautiful about you, Anna, and I think which people really appreciate, is you have that, as well as kind of having this grounding in the knowledge and the understanding and the state of consciousness, you're still very human and you have an abundance of love for things. And I don't know if we want to erase that. I think it's because you're so fully involved in the story, and that if you lost some of that, you might lose some of the magic of the story for yourself in those aspects. Now, we might reconsider this and reassess if the attachment to the ending of things pulled you into a level of suffering which held you back, but I don't know if that's the case. Is that the case? Is this fear of death, a fear of the death with the light on, or is it a fear of death with the light off? What do you think?
That's what's grown over the past few years. The light switch has come on around death. Yeah, and I go, there's kind of more of a feeling of inner resilience. I can kind of handle whatever's thrown whatever comes up. And if that's death, I think it will be okay, because what I will have to just do is feel bodily sensations. So
yeah,
there's the light's on. But what I would say, I don't think that makes it necessarily any easier. Maybe it makes it some things feel more purposeful.
Now, I don't want to tell you what you're experiencing, but I'm not so sure if this is, strictly speaking, just a fear of death, because I don't know if you're completely bound by that. For me, what you're describing sounds like an abundance of love and not wishing to peek behind the veil for fear of losing some of the intensity of the experience of life.
Can you say that in another way? Well, they're not wishing to peek behind the veil?
What I mean is that I believe there's a deeper understanding in you that creation, maintenance and destruction are always happening in this eternal play, and that nothing's ever fully lost. But that there's a level of ignoring or innocence in order to preserve the liveliness of the story.
Uh-huh.
It's like when you're watching a film, if you keep reminding yourself it's a film all the time,
yeah,
it's not as much fun, and yeah, you don't get into it in the same way.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is a little bit of what we call Laisha Vidya within you, maybe. Mm. Laisha Vidya means the faint remains of ignorance.
Mm.
And in your case, it's designed to preserve your personality and its sweetness and its innocence.
Mm. Yeah, I guess like, because a level of ignorance isn't a negative thing in the Vedic worldview, is it? And it kind of can also keep you relevant and engaged in the story of life.
Yeah, and I think yours is spontaneous, but it serves that same purpose.
Ah, I really like that turnaround.
Hmm.
So something I've been practicing lately though, like if I'm with, I don't know if anyone else does this or if I'm crazy, but I might be with like a family member and go, oh my God, what if like they died tomorrow or something?
And everyone does.
Good. I thought I was maybe just being a bit crazy, but, and then I feel that anxiety, and then in that moment I do a little turnaround and I go, just love more here now. Just love harder. Just lean in. Just like be more present to this moment and try and move into like, I guess, gratitude rather than loss.
And that's what I think I was just trying to say, that the innocence or the ignorance even can make you love harder.
Yeah. Yes.
So my next question, that it might be the same answer. I was going to say, what's been the hardest teaching to apply, to embody? Is that the same answer?
I think it is the same answer. I think that there was ignorance is bliss sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm getting a little bit less ignorant around some things. And it's clear to me more what nature's telling me a lot of the time. And sometimes nature's saying, this needs to finish. And I can't really ignore that anymore. And there was a safety and a comfort when I used to be able to ignore that more. Yeah,
so you're getting better at taking a hint rather than ignoring the hints and waiting for the punch in the face.
Yeah, and if I'm not, I know what I'm. I know that that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay, so what are the top three tips you'd give to anyone who's embarking on a spiritual journey or self-development journey?
Find yourself a really good teacher. Check. I think from my own experience, it shouldn't feel like pressure, and it shouldn't feel like there are shoulds and that you know, that you're being forced into anything. And there's going to be – sometimes it's going to be difficult, but I don't think it should feel wrong either. Is that two tips or is that one merged into two? I don't know.
I'd say that's two.
Three. Oh, this is something I've been thinking lately. There's no end point. You know, like I'll go through these stages and I learn so much and I'm like, wow, I've learned so much and that's all resolved now. And then this new thing comes up and that's all part of it. And that, don't think that there's an end point. And if you do, then it's going to cause suffering. Well, it has for me. So just like the whole of life is it, and it never stops.
You can go a fourth if you want.
A fourth. One more thing that I like, okay, I guess a turnaround that I've had for myself is just be curious
instead of being judgmental or feeling like you know everything, just be curious. Yeah, to be constantly open to learning more and open to the fact that you don't know much or anything yet.
Brilliant. Love those tips. So four tips for the price of three. Okay, so last question. Having learned all this stuff, what do you think is the meaning of life? Or to put it another way, what's the point in life for you?
I like this question. Someone asked me recently what my favorite thing to do was, and other people were like, art, poetry, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, learn. Like, I really, really like learning, hence why I think I ask so many questions all the time about everything to an annoying point. But I think to learn and unfurl and evolve. And in that, there's all these really cool, beautiful experiences like being able to love people and connect more. And it's probably chuck a bit of self-realization in there too.
Yeah, and I'd say that's why life's going so well for you and you feel fulfilled, because that's the point of life from nature's perspective as well. Its one agenda is evolution, or to put it another way, everything and everyone learning and growing. So you're very much in alignment with nature, and the more aligned we are with nature, the less we'll suffer and the happier we'll feel.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that with us today, Anna.
Thank you.
And we'll be back to the normal format next time. We hope you've enjoyed this little excursion into Anna's journey. And we'll see you soon. Lots of love and Jai Guru Dev.
Jai Guru Dev.
If you're enjoying these very Vedic podcasts, the best way you can support us is by either tapping the stars or leaving us a short review in Apple Podcasts. We'd really appreciate that. Production and theme music by Al Royale.